Today's episode is brought to you by Canby Foursquare Church. Since 1978, a place to grow, connect, and serve. In-person services are back with some restrictions to help ensure everyone stays safe and healthy. For the latest, visit their website at canbyfoursquare.com.
Welcome to Now Hear This, Canby,
your source for news.
The threat of a possible teacher strike was avoided this week.
There's a new irresistibly cute creature winning over fans, and its name is Scootaloo.
Sports?
It's like Lucy in the football. You want to kick a field goal, but they take it away from you.
We had to learn how to win.
Goal can't be in the last second of the game!
And interesting conversations.
Because I'm one of the strongest girls ever, and I know that for a fact.
I just really enjoy writing gossip as if I was a bear.
With an old maid daughter that make the best moonshine in the coast.
If it would have hit me in the face, I think I would have died. I really do.
I guarantee you would have died, man. Are you kidding me?
Hey friends, and welcome to this episode of Now Hear This, Canby. I am your host, James Walton. So grateful to have each of you join us. Let's read the news. Oregon City voters have selected current City Commissioner Rachel Lyles Smith as their newest mayor, replacing Dan Holliday, who in November became the first mayor in the city's history to be successfully recalled from office. In initial results Tuesday night, Lyles Smith was the choice among a field of five, which also included a formal mayoral candidate, Damon Mabee, Philip Heppner, Alex Josephi, and Leslie Wright Jr. "I want to thank the folks who supported my campaign. I couldn't have done it without them," Lyles Smith told the Canby Current Tuesday night. "And, of course, I want to thank the voters who are putting their trust in me to lead our city. After a very tumultuous 2020, I believe we are looking forward to brighter days ahead." In the unofficial results, Lyles Smith won in what amounted to be a landslide in the crowded field, with 42% of the more than 7,000 votes cast. Businessman and motivational speaker Leslie Wright Jr. was second with 30%. Lyles Smith said she is looking forward to working with her current colleagues on the City Commission on a variety of issues that are important to residents, many of which she said she heard from constituents during the campaign. She said she was motivated to run because she felt like she was qualified for the position and that she would have a lower learning curve than any of the four newcomers who had sought the post. Not only is she a sitting commissioner, but she had served as commission president and interim mayor before Holliday's recall. "I felt I was the most capable of stepping into the position, knowing what was going on and being up to speed," Lyles Smith said. "I really feel like our community needed some stability." Lyles Smith will be sworn in as mayor after the vote has been officially certified, likely in April, after which the commission will need to appoint a replacement to fill her own unexpired term. She said the city will seek applications and conduct interviews before making a decision. Holliday had been recalled in a well-organized and well-funded grassroots effort, which appeared to show in the final result with 68% voting in favor of the former mayor's recall. A longtime civil servant, Holliday had also served as city commissioner and on the Oregon City School Board. But he drew the ire of a wide swath of community members for a series of actions and statements throughout last year, from suggesting businesses reopen early in defiance of the state's coronavirus orders, which drew a threatening letter from the Attorney General, to social media statements that were considered racially insensitive. Turnout in the November recall, which was separate from but roughly coincided with the timing of the general election, was much higher than in the special election. Nearly 52% cast ballots on November 10th, while only 27% of eligible voters weighed in this week. When horrific wildfires struck the rural communities of Mallala, Colton, Scotts Mills, Monitor, Yoder, and many others, Foothills Community Church formed a fire relief assistance program dedicated to assisting those affected by the fires. Its purpose was to provide an easy way to accept donations from individuals and organizations that wanted to help, and obviously to disperse those funds and resources to those in need. As Pastor Dale Satram said in a video explaining the program in September, "We have been flooded here at Foothills with people wanting to know, what can we do? How can we help? How can we help our communities and the people who have lost so much because of the devastation of this fire?" Throughout the quick actions of the Mallala-based church, which also has a campus in Beaver Creek, the program served 72 local families who lost their homes or belongings in the destructive fires. Church leadership had decided at the formation of the program that any leftover funds would be donated to local fire districts that help protect and serve the community during the fires. And as an incredible testament to residents' generosity, even, or especially, during trying times, donations far outpaced requests. Because of the Lord's provision and the unity of our people, we are grateful to be able to award grants to Mallala Fire Department, Colton Fire Department, Scotts Mills Fire Department, and the Monitor Yoder Fire Department, Foothills said in a press release. Each department will be awarded a minimum of $30,000. Church staff presented the awards to each district this week. "We are humbled and proud of how our community unites and supports, especially during crises," the church said. "Thank you and well done." For photos, you can find this story on our website, canbefirst.com. A Mallala man died Sunday evening in a single vehicle rollover crash on South Kramer Road near the intersection with Barnard's. Clackamas County Sheriff's Office deputies responded to the scene to find the driver, later identified as 36-year-old Galdino Salazar Jr., had been ejected from his black Chevy Tahoe and was severely injured. The Tahoe had suffered significant damage as it rolled through a berry field and came to rest on its side. Life flight was requested. Deputies and paramedics attempted to revive Salazar with life-saving measures. Sadly, he succumbed to his injuries and died at the scene. A member of the Criminal Reconstruction and Forensic Technicians, CRAFT team, members of the Sheriff's Office Serious Injury Crash Team, and a Clackamas County Deputy Medical Examiner also responded to the scene to continue the investigation. Salazar was found to be in possession of methamphetamine and marijuana at the time of the crash, although impairment had not been determined to be a factor in the fatal crash as of Monday evening. The cause is still under investigation. Governor Kate Brown got the single-shot Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccine at an OHSU clinic in Scappoose Saturday, 1 week after it became the third vaccine to receive emergency authorization from the Food and Drug Administration. It marked a reversal of her previous public statements that said she would not get the vaccine before it was available to the general public. But in a March 6th statement, she cited the need to allay concerns about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. "There have been a number of rumors and misinformation about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine since its approval by the FDA," she said in a statement. "It was important to me to demonstrate today that the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is safe and effective." She went on to state that all three vaccines that have been approved for use in Oregon are safe and effective, and Oregonians should feel comfortable taking them when it is their turn to do so. "Every week, my office hears the question, if these vaccines are so safe, then why hasn't Kate Brown gotten one?" Brown said. "I want to reassure Oregonians that they should feel confident taking any one of the three vaccines available to protect themselves and their loved ones." The state's vaccination efforts have been significantly expanded since the first immunizations came online in December and were available only to the most vulnerable and frontline healthcare workers. Last week, Oregon passed the 1 million doses mark, and teams are now administering more than 20,000 doses each day. In other state COVID news, the Federal Emergency Management Agency has announced Oregon will receive $110 million in federal funding to assist with vaccine distribution efforts. In a separate statement Monday, Brown said the critical funds will be invaluable in the continued ramp-up of vaccination efforts across the state. These emergency funds will bring some welcomed financial relief and will help ensure the cost of vaccinating Oregonians will not be a barrier to our recovery from the COVID-19 pandemic, she said. I want to thank our partners at FEMA for streamlining the public assistance grant process. The expedited funding will help the Oregon Health Authority and the Oregon Office of Emergency Management provide vaccine access to Oregonians and support local vaccination efforts across the state. The $110 million award is funded through FEMA's Public Assistance Grant Program, which reimburses communities for actions taken for response and recovery from a disaster. FEMA reimbursement is paid directly to the Oregon Office of Emergency Management, which then makes disbursements to local and tribal jurisdictions and state agencies that incurred costs related to the vaccine rollout. As it says in the book of Genesis, the Lord said, "Let there be light." And there were collections of photovoltaic modules to collect the sun's rays and convert them into renewable and environmentally friendly energy. Or, you know, something like that. Well, at any rate, the Smyrna United Church of Christ outside Cambie will be putting that teaching to good use with a newly awarded grant of $32,559 from the Portland General Electric for a 13.68 kilowatt ground mount solar array that will offset all of the church's electricity use. Founded in 1891, Smyrna UCC has a congregation of about 100 members and is active in service to the Cambie community, including working with food banks, foster care assistance, and homeless youth assistance. The grant was one of 9 awards to local nonprofits in Portland, Cambie, Salem, Beaverton, and Lake Oswego, totaling more than $1.76 million for solar projects providing renewable energy to their facilities and the local communities they serve. The awards are part of the PGE Renewable Development Fund, which has handed out 75 grants worth more than $16.5 million, creating more than 16.6 megawatts of renewable power generation since the program's inception in 1999. At Portland General Electric, we are providing affordable, reliable, and increasingly clean energy for everyone, said John McFarland, PGE's chief customer officer. We call it an Oregon kind of energy. The Renewable Development Fund is one way we can ensure an equitable, clean energy future for all Oregonians. For a complete list of projects awarded in this year's funding cycle, visit our website, cambiefirst.com.
Stay connected to what matters most this winter with unlimited high-speed internet from DirectLink. While things may look a little different this year, as we all work together to keep everyone as safe and healthy as possible, you can be confident that DirectLink's reliable network will keep your video calls, Snapchats, stories, and photos crystal clear and at your fingertips whenever you need them. In 2021, DirectLink is thankful for all of their amazing members and is proud to be your local internet, video, and voice provider for over 116 years. On the Cambie Conversation today, we're going to be talking about the proposed extension to the Molalla Forest Road logging trail. There's a portion of that trail that's been donated to the city that for some time now the city's been looking at using that to extend the existing trail that goes through the city. We'll be talking with a couple of different people who live along that trail, longtime residents who have various concerns about that project. First up is Ken Baker. He and his wife live on a farm out in the Maxburg area on Elisha Road, own a filbert orchard. And Ken is really going to be, in addition to kind of talking about some of your concerns, is really here to share some of the very colorful history of exactly. the road, which I'm very interested in. So Ken, yeah. welcome.
Thank you.
Why don't you start by telling us a little bit about the history of the road?
Yeah. I guess my earliest recollection of the logging road, I mean, I grew up, my family used to use the logging road to commute if we were going to go up in the foothills above Mullala or go to Mullala. I mean, anybody could hop on the road in Canby, and it was a private but yet publicly used road with no stop signs, basically.
Yeah.
And you could get from Canby to Mullala pretty easy. And
had to dodge a logging truck here and there.
Yep. You wanted to do it after hours was always the best. But the logging bridge where it crosses over the Mullala River has always been kind of a, you know, for a lot of years. And I'm thinking, you know, like the 70s and the 60s was kind of more before my time. But I remember in the 70s and the 80s, the logging bridge was a pretty popular spot for high school age kids, families. It was a hot spot in the summer times.
Yeah.
And kind of a favorite thing to do. You would always see people jumping off the bridge into the river. And so it was a well-used road back in the day.
Yeah.
And I think it was in the mid 80s. No, it was probably the early 80s when the timber company, and I think Cavenham was the last timber company to actually use it for hauling logs.
Yeah.
And they barricaded it, and they dug out with excavators. They dug out both ends of the logging bridge so that it couldn't be accessed. And they put ditches across, oh, maybe quarter to a half mile north of the bridge. And then actually the logging road where it crossed over Maxburg Road, I had a Canby resident explain or remind me about this, but it was actually burnt by a environmental group. Remember the group, I think it was called ELF?
Oh yeah, Environment Liberation Front.
Yes.
Yeah.
They actually burnt that overpass where it went over Maxburg.
Wow.
And that's actually, then they determined that the cost to rebuild it was just too much. And then, so that's when they actually shut it down.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
Yeah, lots of colorful stories.
Yeah.
So the road was built in the early 40s.
Yes.
To be obviously a logging road.
Yep.
It went from somewhere in the Mullala Hills area all the way through Canby to the Willamette River, obviously, which is part many Canby residents know now because that's our existing trail.
Yep.
Where the logs would be taken to be sent up river. So that was in the 40s. You've kind of touched on some of the history, but my understanding, not being from out here, but you've actually even sent me some stuff I have here on my phone from like the 1980s Canby High School publication called Stepping Stone at that time.
Uh-huh.
But in the 70s and the 80s, it really became kind of infamous. And I want you to kind of tell me some of that history, because that's some of your personal history.
Yeah, yeah. You know, there were a lot of that. The logging road was a, like I said, it was a private yet publicly used road, so it really wasn't policed.
Yeah.
And so if there's been cars stolen and abandoned down on that road, there's still one down there. I could show you. But yeah, there was a lot of crime. There were shootings.
Yeah.
You know, there was just basically, it was an isolated area that wasn't policed.
Yeah.
Where
lots of parties.
Lots of parties.
This publication in the early 1980s, what the writers described, I think some of your classmates described as a raunchy bunch.
Yes. Yes, they were.
But frequented.
Yes, yes. And they were the the partiers in the 70s, the 60s, usually a wild bunch. And that was the reputation that it had.
Right. And poaching, you know, things like that happened as well. Trespass, you know, not necessarily like the sexy crimes of murder or stealing cars or whatnot, but things that are very concerning to residents out here is people just coming on their property with guns, you know, potentially.
Oh, yeah.
So,
yeah.
And just unintentionally causing damage or hurting someone. So
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Since I would say the mid 80s into the mid 90s, things really, they I don't think they barricaded the end of Elisha Road off until,
yeah,
I think it was the late 80s, maybe even early 90s. I'd have to look that one up, but it was nothing for us to sit in the backyard on a Saturday evening or a Sunday afternoon, and it was nice summer, warm weather, and there would be cars down on the riverbed, mm-hmm, parked up along the road, clear probably over a quarter mile, maybe even closer to a half mile.
Yeah.
Parked on both sides of the road. There'd be that many people,
yeah,
down there.
Yeah.
And we both, George and I, we remember an instance where a life flight was down there, emergency services, because people were, you know, they drink too much or whatever, and they're jumping off the bridge, and
yeah,
somebody's going to get hurt. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
I think it was in the maybe late 70s or early 80s that there's several bridges along that road, but there was one that was, at least that when it was really built, it was log, and then two spans of it had to be changed into steel and concrete. What do you know about that bridge?
I think that's the logging bridge. It's been built and rebuilt, I believe. I don't know a lot of that history.
Okay.
But the log portion is what they did take off of. So right now all you see is the cement steel structure that spans the river.
Yeah.
And then the logs kind of went from the ends of the bridge to the earth, to the ground, to the land.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's been removed,
yeah,
right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
and you guys are concerned that if this is reopened to the public, you know, however they try to do it, that some of those kind of stories from the olden days would start to come back or more frequently.
Yeah. I think it would come back probably even if it were to be developed, let's say made into a parking lot, made more accessible for the public to go down there and park and get on the trail or get to the river. I would say it would even be probably, could be even a bigger problem than what it was back then, just because,
yeah,
easier access. And, you know, we still see enough evidence on a weekly or monthly basis by people still trying to get to the river down there. They go behind the no trespassing signs.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just a magnet for people, especially when the weather's nice.
Yeah.
So I think it would, and you know, we've seen people, I just had a guy go down there and he was almost too drunk to really understand what he was trying to say to me. And so,
I tried to explain that to you, Ken. I was just having a bad day.
So it's just a remote place where people can go do these kinds of things.
Yeah.
And I just think that's what we're going to see a lot of.
Yeah, yeah. There's one story in this thing you sent me, and we'll share this with you guys. It's a really interesting piece of history, of local history. But when the road was owned by Crown Zellerbach before Weyerhaeuser,
uh-huh,
they actually, according to this, and they're talking with someone who maintained the road for a long time named Howard Hines, said that Crown wanted to turn part of it into a park. And they put in some 55-gallon drums and made them into barbecues and cleared out a place for people to park. And they just showed up one day and everything had been destroyed.
Yeah.
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 Which is unfortunate. I mean, but that's the kind of thing when it's so remote, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think people kind of think that this they see the existing logging trail and it's nice, you know, and they hear about the extension and they think, okay, well, some logging trail is good and more would just be better, but it's not going to be the same.
Right, that's correct. And you just have to believe that there is a certain type of person or people or groups or whatever you want to, however you want to label it, that they just want to be destructive. And if there's something out there that can be taken for scrap metal or stolen, yeah, or trapped, I mean, that's just part of going to the river and having, I mean, they used to bring guns down. They would shoot up all the signs, shoot up, that you would go down there and there'd be cans and targets littered all over the place from just shooting, a lot of shooting.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, just destructiveness.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So later in this podcast, we're going to be talking to Mitch Magenheimer, over on the other end of the road, that what would be the first phase of the extension. You're at the other end.
Yes.
After that interview I did with Mitch, he kind of took me to the portion where the road got all washed out, and it's like just 1,000 feet of just a huge depression. Can you tell us more about that? Because you're kind of at this other end of that. I took some pictures. It is unbelievable,
right,
how much washed out from that road.
Yeah. In fact, I mean, Google Earth or any of those satellite, if you go in and look, you can see the river, how it changed and has gone back and forth over the decades.
It's so much of an understatement to call it a washout. It is like, yes, a canyon. I mean, it is unbelievable. It's,
yeah,
like a crater.
Yep. Yeah. It totally took out the road for quite a ways. And it moved over there for several years, and now it's migrated back.
Yeah.
And just in the recent weather we got this winter, it's actually came back in.
Okay.
So I know there was water, not the main river channel, but the water did rise up right up to where that logging road ends there.
Yeah.
So
what are some of your personal concerns and some of your neighbors out in this area? Because like I said, you know, you wouldn't be part of the first phase. You wouldn't, I don't think, necessarily be part of the second phase. It would be down the road before the trail would necessarily, you know, be in your neck of the woods.
Right, yeah. Right. Probably the first and foremost would be, I think, safety. Safety is the biggest thing.
Yeah.
You know, we're a farming community here. There's a lot of hazelnut orchards. There's grass seed. There's
animals.
Animals.
Yeah.
Horse boarding. There's Nancy has I think she's got 12 or 15 stalls that she boards. Mm. Horse trailers, trucks. Other farmer on the other side of the logging road from us, he's a blueberry farmer. So there's a lot of equipment, a lot of tractor equipment, trucks and trailers that access Elisha Road, as well as, you know, Maxburg and the little driveways and private roads that, you know, are in that same area.
Yeah.
And so safety for the public, if it were to become a bike trail, you know, how does that all connect? I mean, you've got it. Tractor equipment is hazardous to operate.
Yeah.
So combining that with kids on bikes, you're at least on our road, if they were to have Elisha as an access road, you've got a one lane road with a blind hill, steep grade, that when I move my sprayer down there to the lower field to spray the orchard, my boom takes up the whole road. Mm. If I move my disc down there, I'm taking up the whole disc.
Yeah.
Or the whole road.
Yeah.
And I put those orange cones at the top of the hill.
Yeah.
Just to warn the neighbors, I'm down there, right, so they know in their mind.
Oh, Ken's down there.
Ken's down there, yeah. Slow down. He's got a tractor going somewhere. So, but yeah, safety's the biggest thing. And then policing would be the next thing.
Yeah.
If that became an open public pathway to us as neighbors, that's just one more avenue that if somebody wants to steal from you, they can go out, they can go north, they can go south, they can hit an access road.
Yeah.
And we've already been dealing with those problems.
Yeah.
But it would just make it that much easier.
Yeah.
And so that's a big concern.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. Well, Ken, thank you so much for taking time out to talk to us today. We're going to head over to the other side of Canby and go up with Mitch. Is there anything else you want to share with folks or tell folks about it with regard to this issue?
You know, I guess the road was built by timber companies. It was used for 4 or 5 decades by timber companies. That whole time, it was EFU. It's zoned EFU by the county. Timber harvest is farm use. That's farm. And so it was EFU, and it's still EFU today. If you go to the county maps, it's still zoned EFU. And our feeling is that this is EFU ground out here. It's for farming. And so the changes that would have to take place, or the interruptions to farming, the hazards would just increase. And so those are our big concerns.
Sure.
Yeah.
Thanks, Ken. Mm-hmm. Joining us now is Donna Ellison of Ellison Team Homes, a firm serving all across the Portland metro area with 3 realtors based right here in Canby. Donna, can you tell us how Ellison Team Homes started?
I started in real estate. I grew up with my dad. He was a realtor. Mm-hmm. So I'm a second generation broker, and I grew up with him on weekends. And I learned a lot eventually working with him for several years and then going out on my own. Our family moved to Canby a couple of years ago, but we really didn't know how it was going to go. And within the first probably 3 months of being here, we literally fell head over heels in love with this place. We love the community, the spirit here. The first Christmas at Waite Park, I was literally crying because everybody was walking around saying Merry Christmas and people were drinking hot chocolate, and we got in a carriage ride with the horse, and it was just too much. You just realize it's special here. Real estate's always been my passion. It is my professional love. I enjoy the people, the relationships. So much comes out of kind of the intensity that you spend with people. You're really up in their business for a period of time, and sometimes it's a couple months, sometimes it's a couple years, sometimes it's a lifetime.
Yeah.
I feel very blessed at this point to have people that have been with me for almost my entire career. Mm-hmm. Clients that have bought and sold maybe 2, 3, 4, or 5 homes. I have one client that's bought and sold 8 homes with me.
Yeah.
3 generations. It's a beautiful business. It makes for a very full life. Mm-hmm.
How can people find you?
How can they not, really? we have a website, www.ellisonteamhomes.com.
Well, thank you, Donna.
Thank you for having me.
Logging road.
Yeah.
You know, all the history, backstory, all that good stuff. But the deed restriction through this section of the road from 13th clear down to the gun club says the path, if they're to build a trail, has to be on the east side of the road. They can't be in the road. They can't, you know, all that. The gun club has basically the right to use the road. So do the neighbors down the road here.
Yeah.
Because the only ingress egress. So always going to be.
The gun club's been here forever.
Yeah. It's been a long time. They were in the 50s. They shot on this property.
Okay.
And then they moved over to this property there, I believe, in 1961 or something like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's been there a long time.
Yeah.
But in the deed, when Nancy deeded it over to the city, there's a restriction that they have to build the path on the east side of the road through this strip.
Yeah. And so if you've got 13th behind you and you don't know compass directions like I don't, I'm obviously sitting here with Mitch and can see, but it's to the left side of the continuation of this road here is what you're saying on the east side. So.
Correct.
Yeah.
And so as we head through, this is where the existing fence line is. There's obviously some tree removal and there's a ditch and there's some things they'd have to do to try to improve on that side of the road.
Yeah.
Not such an issue on the first 200-300 yards here.
Yeah.
But just as soon as we start to crest over the hill is where the first obstacle comes that it was not priced into the quote bit.
Real quick, Mitch, I wanted to ask you, because the thing about it having to be on the east side is where it ends now is on the other side.
Correct.
So how would they switch over?
That's another good question.
Yeah.
They show some alternative, what do I want to call it? Alternative intersection realignments.
That's a busy road. Yeah.
Exactly. So that's one challenge at the beginning.
Yeah.
There's no parking also. So if somebody wants to come and get on, they either got to go up and park somewhere on 13th, there's not really anywhere until you get into the housing development.
There's
Timber
Park. There's a couple spaces there on that new Sequoia part that they built. But yeah,
so
I hear you there.
This becomes the first hurdle they will have to cross.
Okay.
So they have to build the path on the east side.
Right.
And as you can tell, there is no land on the east side to just easily build on.
Yeah.
There's a drainage,
some woods,
creek, wetland
very
down here.
Wet.
There's a creek that actually runs down through here and it continues right across under the road.
Okay.
So you'd have to build out and infill in this chunk of wetland in order to put a path on that side of the road.
Yeah.
To not obstruct the road itself.
Okay.
And so their designs, I think in the stuff I sent you, showed anywhere between, what was it, an 8 and 12 foot path, you know, whatever they decide.
Right.
So in order to get 8 to 12 feet on the top of this hill, you got to fill much more on the bottom side.
And again, these are the first part of what would be the new path.
Correct.
Right? I mean, these are
this
challenges
the first
that are down
yards.
The road.
Yeah,
this
first couple hundred yards.
For any of the new stuff to come online.
Yes, this is phase one, segment one. This would be the first part. One of the proposals is they want it to have an equestrian trail attached with it.
Okay.
This is proposed to be the 300-yard rifle range right here beside, and this is the longest strip we have as the gun club. That could create a challenge having a 300-yard rifle range right beside a walking and equestrian trail.
I could imagine some challenges. Is it used currently by the gun club?
Yeah, not the distance, but right now there's a trap house already out here. So yes,
that.
Right next to the road is used actively for trap shooting.
Okay.
The fence line, existing fence lines that come through here are very close to the road. Right through here is only a 40-foot wide easement, or not easement, but deeded path for the road.
Yeah.
It's only 40 feet wide. And so after you get off of the road, which is just a hair over 20, that only leaves you about 8 feet on either side if the road is in the exact center. So not a lot of room to work with on either side.
Yeah.
This is another low drainage. This is all in the 100-year floodplain, this property down here. So obviously there's water here. This is a little bit of a marshy wetland. Again, you'd have to fill in order to go through there.
And they can't do it here.
This is the gun club property.
Gotcha.
On that side.
Okay.
And the deed restriction says it has to be on this side.
Gotcha. Okay.
Now you get to my fence corner. And this is where the historical fence line has always been. It's never been moved. So I'm assuming that's roughly the property line. And there's not a full 8 to 10 feet across there.
So it's almost right up to the road.
Yeah. So if they had to do something, again, they may have to consider purchasing private property in order to make a path on the east side of the road through here.
Yeah.
So now we come up to where the road has been historically closed off and only kept for private property ingress, egress back here.
Yeah.
So once you get through the gate here,
Who closes it?
Nobody does right now.
Okay.
In fact, it is open, but there's just that. That's where it was historically gated off.
Yeah. I've never been.
Okay. So yeah. So now it's kept open basically for the sake of this is the 100% ingress egress for the properties at the end of the road. There are three houses down there, farm field, another Filbert field, and I have access. My next door neighbor has access, and the Yo's do from Mark's Meats
and
up there.
Your only access.
I can get in off Molino Road.
Okay.
But not the rest of the neighbors down
the
road.
Okay.
Fortunately, I'm close enough on the corner here that we can get in and out off Molino or off the logging road.
Gotcha.
So their next step was to then cross over to the other side of the road to get back onto the what they call the west side, which is now the southwest side.
Okay.
As we start in through here. About right in here is where they're proposing to cross back over to the other side.
Okay.
As you can tell, I've had to put up no hunting, no trespassing, no water access, no fishing signs.
Yeah.
Because we get people lined up and down through here crossing my private property to get to the water.
Right.
Because they think, because the road's here, it's public access.
Right. And that's something that we heard from Ken, you know, some of the history of out here as well has been an issue for decades. It's poaching and trespassing and things. So.
Yep. And so you can tell the damage from the water when it came through here. Good golly, in January, the water level came up to about 4-5 feet below the road right up here.
Yeah.
So it comes up very high.
This was underwater. The river, or
this is the Milk Creek still.
Okay.
So the water does come up and get high through this strip right through here, this low area, when we get a flooding event.
Yeah.
It was around 2012, this whole strip from right where we're at right here up for a good 100+ feet washed out right up to the road.
Yeah.
Right, literally about outside your door, was right straight down in the creek.
Yeah.
In order to shore that up, you know, when the water came down, it moved back over to the channel and this got back filled in, back up safely. But that's something that can happen. It happened here, it happened right up with the neighbors.
Yeah.
So the trail is intended to be on that side of the road. I don't see how you can infill in the creek to get through this strip, but this is one of the challenges. In order to maintain the ingress egress for my driveway and barn access, there's not a lot of room to move the road. You're gonna have to take out large trees, the phone lines. I mean, there's some challenges with trying to switch it back and forth as you zigzag.
Yeah.
Again, this is a road. You have delivery trucks coming up and down on a regular basis. If you look up above the white strip there on my above my barn doors, on the far door, right about the middle, up about 5 feet, you can see a bullet hole.
Yeah.
In the back of my barn. Came from that direction this way because...
Wow. Not from the gun club.
Not from the gun club. Coming from the east side of our property.
Yeah.
But those are the things that go on out here. There's a lot of shooting and other things. And so it can be challenging.
Right.
Where this little rise in the road here is, in 1998, the road, there was a bridge here and it washed out. Yule Tree Farm came in and dropped two culverts and just filled it with rock and called it good to get through here. This is not wide enough to do a path on either side. So that's another constraint that they're going to have with making a trail on that side as you drop off another 12 feet right off.
I'm looking out my window. It drops off so steep.
Yes, it's just straight off the edge.
Yeah.
And in order to put a 12-foot path out there, you're going to have to infill in a wetland.
I don't know horses too well, but I don't think they're going to like that.
They're not. So that's some of the challenges with trying to construct it through this strip in the first place.
Yeah.
Just where the, and actually right about here, the road goes now into a 60-foot wide easement down through here.
Okay.
So it varies from 40 to 60, and I just know what it is on my place. It's 40 up until about right where we were just at. Now as we come through, they're obviously running the direct link lines and stuff, and so this is all tore up on that side. But right here at my neighbor's, again, the creek washed out right up to the edge of the road. These are the ongoing maintenance and repair items that they haven't priced in either or thought about.
Yep.
Just kind of talk about, well, that's something that we'll need to consider.
Yeah.
But before you jump into a project, that's something that should be really thought of. Now, I'll send you some pictures when we're all done from where I was just parked at, where that I was telling you the culverts were put in.
Yeah.
In 2009, everything from that where we were parked this way is underwater. In the 2009 flooding. Mm. It's happened 3 times in the 17 years I've lived here, where everything from there this way is underwater.
Mm-hmm.
So makes the road inaccessible, obviously the path would be, and after those events, that's when we wind up with very large repairs and whatever that need to be done throughout this road.
And Mitch, as we're continuing to drive along a little ways, I so appreciate you taking time to drive us down and kind of show, because I want people to understand that this is not just, oh, I don't want walkers or horses into my backyard. You guys see very real, significant, and expensive challenges to doing this project, and you're just wanting to make sure that information is being considered, and maybe the public dollars should be spent elsewhere and for a project or a type of thing that more folks would want than trying to overcome these extremely significant challenges to do something that folks might otherwise want.
Exactly. One of the biggest things that questions I have asked is, have we asked the taxpayers of Canby, who will be ultimately responsible for paying for the trail, paying for the maintenance, is this truly what they want? Do they want dog parks? Do they want sports fields? As we've been in COVID for the last year, I'm the president of the Whiskey Hill Kids Soccer Club out there at 91 grade school, and we've not been able to use the sports fields for a year. We finally this week are getting access back to the fields.
Wow.
But when you look at the availability of field space, it's very tight.
Yeah.
There's a lot of competing uses for the same fields. Therefore, there is a shortage of sports fields in the Canby School District.
And again, we're outside of city limits at this point.
Correct. We're an exclusive farm use property. Now, this becomes one of the next challenges. This is a bridge that's been in place since they built the road back in the 40s. It's 12 feet wide.
It's very cool.
Yeah, it's a cool bridge. Looking. There's just, for safety purposes, there's not a guardrail on it.
Yeah. When did you say it was put in?
In the 40s or 50s is when this was put in. And one of the constraints comes if you put railing on it, when farm implements come through here, you can see the scratch marks on both sides. If you wipe some of the moss off there, where the implements have bumped on both sides. So if you put guardrails on, then you've been restricted the ability for the farm implements to get through here. But again, it's not a very safe bridge to have little kids walking up and down on and going back and forth.
Yeah.
As well as expanding a bridge here, you've got to cross the Milk Creek. There's going to be some costs that are going to be, I'm assuming, very high if you have to put a new bridge in, widen the bridge, or create another path.
Yeah. About how long is it?
That is, I'm going to say it's about a 60-foot bridge.
Okay.
Now we cross it, this is another section. To build down in there, again, you're filling in a wetland, and you'll notice back when the road was constructed back in the 40s, you'll notice that it looks like it's kind of dug out through here.
Yeah.
That's not really a natural drainage. They dug the rock up from there and put it up here on the road to build the road up.
Oh, okay.
Because obviously the road would have been at a much lower elevation.
Gotcha.
So this is an area, again, where most likely it would have to be infilled. I'm assuming there's going to be wetland fill permits and what have you that would have to go with that.
Mm-hmm. It is pretty.
But again, it just drops right straight off.
Yes. Yeah, it's about at least a 10-foot drop.
At least, yep. And so these ponds back here, they're not really natural. I mean, they came from digging the rock so they could build the road back when the road was constructed.
And that was Weyerhaeuser?
Oh, gosh. It was before Weyerhaeuser. It was, I want to say, Crown Zellerbach that was in charge of that back in the day.
Back in at least the 80s, I know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And this dates back into the 40s when this was all built. And so it used to be just a clear path straight from the hills up out of Mullala to the Willamette River.
Yeah.
And so this is where the road is historically blocked off.
Okay.
And so they talk about stopping access right here for the public. Basically, you go right up here to the end of this, and it drops right off as far as about 10 feet down, and it goes into the old river channel.
Okay.
The river washed out in, I want to say it was 09, where it was running right through this area. It moved back down to the south, I want to say, in 2012.
Okay.
So this is the challenge with doing anything down here is the Mullala River is a wild, scenic type river where there is no dams on the entire river system, so it moves wherever it wants to go when we get high water events.
Yeah.
And on average, we'll get 1 to 2 a year that are high water, light stage flooding. About every 10 years, we've been having a full-scale flooding event. Mm. So there's some of the maintenance things that are gonna come from washouts and high water events.
Yeah.
And this is a road.
Yeah.
It is used as a driveway. It's used for deliveries. It's used for agricultural purposes, for ingress and egress. It will always be a motorized road because these properties have no other access.
Yeah.
And so it will make it very difficult to change that piece of this trail.
Yeah.
And I feel like one of the misleading things that's been done is most people think this is a trail that goes, we'll go to Mullala. It's a trail that will be non-motorized, and it's going to give us river access. So if you wanted river access on the city's property, now that we're almost a mile and a half down the trail, this is the first place where you could potentially get to the river. But you can't even see the river from here.
No.
It's still another 800 yards from here. Or not 800 yards. About 900 feet
from here. It's out through the break over there in the trees, about 300 yards off. And that's the closest access to the river at this point in time. Again, the easement through here is only 60 feet wide.
Yeah.
So there's not a lot of room for parking, as you can tell. There's no services down here. There's no running water. There's no gas, electric. It's just to the local properties up there. So some of the challenges with bringing in equestrian and stuff, this would be the place where they could park. But in order to make a facility, you're going to have to infill in these wetland areas in order to find a place to park.
Or emergency services.
Correct.
Yeah.
So these are some of the challenges that I see that I don't feel have been addressed. And for me personally, as a taxpayer, if I'm going to be on the hook of paying for this and ultimately being responsible from the fiscal end, I want to be asked, hey, what other things would you consider doing with this money? Because I know there's a lot of people that want sports fields. They want off-leash dog parks. A lot of people want stuff that's accessible in town. There's other property in town that, you know, the city could improve upon, or, you know, if it was buying a piece of property to put sports fields on, what makes the best sense for the residents and the taxpayers who are going to be paying for it?
And
I feel like those questions have not been asked yet, and this is just kind of being pushed through that this will be an easy trail, this will be an easy this. But again, it's not going to be, it's going to be always going to be a motorized road, not a trail, because through this section.
Right.
I just feel like the cart's a little ahead of the horse. I feel like they haven't done as much true cost estimate to get a realistic cost. The maintenance side, during the ice storm we just had, we, the residents that live along here, came down and we had the road cleared so that everybody could get in and out by 10 o'clock on Saturday morning, because there were 7 or 8 trees across the road just from my place to where we're at right now. So we came out, we cleared all the trees out so people could get, the residents down here could get out. Those are the issues that, it, based upon the other trees that were down in town, the city wouldn't have had time to get to for days because this affects three families down here. So it's one more thing for the city to have to manage. You have almost a mile and a half of road to manage for three residents that live down here for ingress, egress purposes. And I have little kids. I have 4 kids, and I don't even feel safe letting them go up and down the road here on the bicycles, because there is cars that drive up and down it. So there's safety risks that, you know, I as a parent think about, but then there's the fiscal cost of what is this really going to cost the taxpayers, and what kind of benefit are they truly going to get out of it? So those are my biggest concerns that I don't feel have been addressed by the bike committee to this point.
Hey friends, James here again. Just wanted to break in to give you a bit of an update to this story. We reached out to the city of Canby with the concerns that you heard mentioned in the story, and they provided a very detailed response, including this statement I'm about to read. MFR neighbors, including those participating in the Stakeholder Advisory Committee, the SAC, have provided a lot of valuable information about the MFR, especially the roadway section. They have described challenges related to flooding, described the types of vehicles and heavy equipment that use the MFR roadway, described experiences with trespassing and property damage, and described the maintenance that they have been performing and continue to perform. The City of Canby, Parametrics, and the Bike and Ped Advisory Committee, BPAC, have listened to neighbors' concerns over the course of 3 90-minute Zoom meetings, SAC, and the exchange of letters and phone calls. I generally understand the concerns to be about security, safety, and maintenance. Parametrics has advised that the concerns raised can be addressed through design and have suggested designs and provided cost estimates in the draft development plan. Adjacent property owners' input is valuable and was sought out by the BPAC. We have received letters of input from Molalla Riverwatch, Canby Rod and Gun Club, Ken and Georgia Baker, and neighbors, and emails and phone calls from residents. These are kept on file and shared with Parametrics and BPAC.
Hey, Frankie, you okay? You seem kind of down.
Yeah, I'm just bummed. I miss going to the Wild Hair. I know you can still get takeout and all, but it's just not the same.
You know they're open again, right?
What?
Yeah, they've been open for a while now. Don't you cover, like, the news?
Hey, I'm only human, okay?
Okay. Well, I can tell you that the Wild Hare and their amazing staff are thrilled to be open again for delicious meals and fun times. They are strictly following all the recommended safety guidelines, and they have the only covered outdoor patio in Canby, with lots of tables spaced 6 feet apart and umbrellas also spaced 6 feet apart, and fantastic ambiance. And hey, if you're still more comfortable with carryout, they can hook you up there too. Find their menu and other information online at thewildhairsaloon.net or check them out in Canby in Oregon City. Anything to add, Frankie? Frankie? Oh, I guess he left. God, he must have been really hungry. Now Hear This Canby is produced by me, Tyler Clausen. Our content director and star reporter is Tyler Frankie. And of course, our show is edited by Cameron Clausen. We also feature the vocal talents of Joy Struby and James Walden. So a round of applause to them. The song that you're hearing right now is Canby by singer-songwriter Olivia Harms, used with her permission. To find more work from her, you can visit her website, olivia13.com.
Now Hear This Canby is dedicated to preserving independent local journalism and redefining local news with our fun, fresh, and energetic brand of storytelling. Our sincere thanks to our local sponsors who make this show possible. Please show your appreciation by supporting the small businesses who support us.
The production of Now Hear This Studios, Canby's locally owned, full-service audio, video, and media production company. Our mission is to produce the best content in the universe, and we'd love to help you do it. Find us online at nhtstudios.com.
I will take a motion to adjourn.
I just moved it.
I didn't even ask for it, though.